Hey everybody, welcome to another episode of Classes of Male. My name is Alan Gygax, and today we are going to talk about presidential candidate Mike Kariff. This is in anticipation of an interview that I have coming up with him. And so, as you guys know, I've read the CLC, the Concerned Letter Carriers platform, and discussed that. And I've had James Henry on in the past, and I've had Mike Kariff on as well, but he reached out to me and was interested in talking about his platform, and I feel like that's something that is definitely worth discussing. So on this episode, I'm going to read the platform, and I'm going to give some commentary, and so we're all on the same page for when I interview Mike Kariff. As I record this, I'm going to be interviewing him sometime tomorrow. Presumably, these two episodes will be released around the same time as well. So let's get started. This comes from the Kariff for Prez website. It's C-A-R-E-F, the number 4, P-R-E-Z.org. And this is the Kariff plan. Here we go. It is titled A Union of Letter Carriers for Letter Carriers. Sisters and brothers, our beloved union stands at a crossroads. Our national leadership team, headed up by Brian Renfro and Executive Vice President Barner, has lost the will to lead us in the fight. We rarely challenge the things the Postal Service does to us, either through national grievances or interpretive issues, with the Board of Governors, with Congress, through the media, or with the general public. As we see our working conditions and standard of living decline, and as we look toward the future with great trepidation, we need to elect a new president who has a viable plan and strategy, and the ability to carry it out on our behalf. Today, I offer you this roadmap for our future. A plan to revitalize the membership, improve our organization, and get us a contract that serves our needs now and into the future. Along the way, we must also save the Postal Service from itself. Please read on. All right, so that's kind of the intro. And then there's a table of contents, which I'm going to skip because we're going to read all this stuff anyway. And right off the bat, credit where it's due. Mike seems like a pretty good writer. I like the way it flows. I like the passion. That's something that I've always liked about Mike Kariff, is that he comes across as a passionate, energetic leader, and that's great. All right, next. Point number one here, national contract. As a labor union, there is nothing more important than the terms of our national contract, the black and white. Note, a lot of this stuff in here is in quotes, like it's the quote black and white, end quote. I'm not going to bother reading when it's in quotes. I don't know. It's just a stylistic choice, but he uses it often enough that I feel like it would get distracting. All right, so moving on. Nothing is more important than the black and white. When we elect a new president in 2026, we will be electing the person that shall have the authority and responsibility for carrying out the collective bargaining duties of the union. When our brothers and some sisters let us out on a wildcat strike in 1970 that was not sanctioned by the union, they achieved two things that have served all letter carriers since then. The first was collective bargaining, which replaced collective begging. The second thing was a change in the law and the birth of the Postal Reform Act of 1970. Section 101 is postal policy. Section A establishes that the newly formed United States Postal Service shall be operated as a basic and fundamental service provided to the people. And Section C states the following. As an employer, the Postal Service shall achieve and maintain compensation for its officers and employees comparable to the rates and types of compensation paid in the private sector of the economy of the United States. It shall place particular emphasis upon opportunities for career advancements of all officers and employees and the achievement of worthwhile and satisfying careers in the service of the United States. All right, so for me, as you know, I'm an outsider to what goes on at National, and I would love to know more about what Brian Renfro negotiated on, but of course he kept that secret from us. And still, even after passage of resolutions at the convention instructing him to inform us of what the process was, he still hasn't done it. But to me, this is really where it's at. Like, this is the basis of our argument in arbitration. that the Postal Service has this obligation, and it's laid out in the law, and the Postal Service has to obey the law, and it does so by paying us comparable rates to the private sector. All right, so that's the quote from the law, and of course, Cariff is going to go on and address it. He writes, continuing, "Today, the wages that we've negotiated don't achieve worthwhile and satisfying careers. As a matter of fact, career letter carriers are quitting their jobs at an alarming rate. As your president, I will make sure we achieve a contract representing a career that today's worker wants to have. This can be achieved through collective bargaining. The Postal Service can't be successful without a dedicated and consistent group of professional letter carriers getting the nation's mail and package delivered. Collective bargaining means the contract must be good for both sides. It's not in the service's interest to have such a high turnover rate, to pay so much in overtime and penalty overtime, to pay out so much in grievance settlements, dude, and if the, and to have an unhappy workforce. A contract that addresses these issues is a must. And if the management team of the Postal Service refuses to work with us, then we'll go through the tri-party arbitration panel to get there." So obviously I like what I'm reading here that, you know, it's the Postal Service has an interest and an obligation to hire this steady workforce and to make it a career, and they're not meeting that obligation. All right, moving on. "Here's a list of items that I developed prior to the 2023 contract negotiations. Most of these things were not addressed in the tentative agreement, which laid out the terms that were implemented by arbitrator slash mediator Nolan on March 21st, 2025. These are things that must be addressed in a new contract, and we will fight for them as part of the struggle to make the letter carrier job a good job again. Currently, pay and benefits are not comparable to the private sector of the economy of the United States, and particularly UPS drivers. Instead, our pay is comparable to other crafts within the service. Crafts that don't face the dangers that we do, the level of harassment that we do, aren't on their feet on the street all day like we are, and aren't the public face of the Postal Service like we are. The fact that starting pay for career clerks is higher than that of career city letter carriers is something that we can't tolerate any longer. The fact that it takes 10 years just to start receiving a middle-class wage is not acceptable either. The non-career CCA classification and the Table 2 pay structure must go." So with our pay as compared to the clerks have a higher starting pay. And as I understand it, as the pay chart goes on, we wind up having a higher finishing pay. But this is a good arguing point, because how are we going to get people to come in and get quality candidates? Anybody can see we're not getting good candidates like we used to. You know, we don't have that civil service exam. We're really just kind of having to take anybody who applies, and then we can't keep them when we get them. And this can't be a sustainable business model for the Postal Service. You know, it was either Michael or Fred Woodley was talking to me about that. I think it was Trevor, my buddy. It doesn't matter. One of my friends was talking to me about this, that it feels like we're taking the Amazon approach to our hiring, where we're just going to take somebody off the street, we're going to use them up, burn them out, and discard them. And when they quit, we'll just bring in another one. And man, that is not the way the Postal Service is intended to operate. Not according to the laws that we read that Mike put at the beginning of this platform. All right, moving on. "We will also make sure Congress, the Board of Governors, and the American people are aware of our contract goals. It is absolutely in the interest of the American people that we have a good contract so that the service that the law requires can continue. Having a letter carrier that comes to every home and business to deliver and pick up what they may want to place in the mail stream is one of the greatest services of all time, and it's free to all American citizens 6 days a week. The American people and their representatives in Congress are our natural allies when we go to negotiate a new contract." This is something that Michael Brazenly and I have talked about at length, is that we should be enlisting public support. We have public support. We enjoy broad public support. Why aren't we mobilizing that when it's time to negotiate? I remember at a rap session here in Vegas, the one time that I saw President Renfro before the convention, he said that he didn't think that his counterpart across the table, which I guess would be Doug Tolino, would respond well to public pressure, and that's why he decided not to utilize it. In hindsight, I mean, that had to be a mistake. It's not like we would have gotten a worse contract. All right, moving on. Let's look at just one issue as an example of this collective approach. Mandatory overtime. Oh, dude, if you're going to pick one, that's the one. First, we're not interested in slowing down the overtime you're getting now, if that's what you desire. However, many letter carriers want to be able to get off work to be with their kids or indulge in hobbies, etc. Giving up any semblance of a work-life balance should not be a condition of employment. Our employer has problems here too. When people quit because they're constantly assigned to work, it exasperates the staffing issue in that post office. Another is that sometimes they bring in carriers from other offices, putting them up in hotels and paying expenses to get the mail delivered. So how do we solve this collective problem? First, let's recognize that it is possible. The rural carriers already have this language in their contract. Second, okay, so he says they have the language, but it doesn't say what the language is. So maybe that's something I'll have to ask him about when I interview him tomorrow. Second, let us obligate local management to ask for non-ODL volunteers, including ODL carriers in neighboring offices, and utilize the auxiliary workforce before forcing a non-ODL carrier to work overtime off their assignment. Interestingly, I think Fred Woodley has this in his LMOU, where he delivers in Ohio, that you can actually take ODLs from other stations before mandating in an attempt to give overtime carriers more of the overtime they want and to help fewer non-ODL carriers get mandated. It's a solution that is demonstrably achievable. Okay, so next. Next, when they mandate overtime, there must be a high price, at least penalty overtime, plus an obligation to solicit new hires. I like that. I like that a lot because they're proving that they can't get the job done with the staffing they have now. He goes on. You get the idea. It does not make any sense contractually that the employer has exclusive hiring rights under Article 3, but if they decide not to schedule a letter carrier on a particular route on a particular day, it becomes the responsibility of the other regular letter carriers in that office. This is such a good point, that management is supposed to staff. But when management doesn't staff properly, management doesn't suffer from that. The carriers suffer from that. This is management's failing, and mandated carriers are the ones who are forced to suffer from it. It's such a valid point. You know, we have the situation like at my own station where we're being mandated, but we have carriers from our office who are 204Bs. So management is making sure that management's fully staffed at the expense of the letter carrier. Moving on. Unfortunately, the Postal Service's management team has become dysfunctional and self-serving, and thus they may not enter into serious negotiations to change the multitude of things that need fixing in the contract. In that case, we must be prepared to win at arbitration, starting with picking a neutral arbitrator willing to take a fresh look at the situation and work together to find solutions. The next step is to make sure we have the people in the room who can explain why the status quo does not work and how our solutions will. I plan to use the enormous talent that we have in our union's arbitration advocates to achieve that. It's inexplicable that we leave our greatest assets on the bench and rely solely on attorneys when we go to national arbitration. So, to comment here, I'm sure that there are good reasons to have attorneys take part in your arbitration argument. You know, they're going to speak language that other attorneys understand. But to Mike's point, many hands makes light work. You know, having more people working on this problem and people who argue on behalf of letter carriers day in and day out, I think he's exactly right here, that this is an untapped resource. That why aren't we utilizing this? You know, when Renfro says, like, oh, I'm going to go it alone with these negotiations and, you know, I'll take whatever fallout, we see the results of that. We see the results of going alone. There's more than one person who has good ideas. You know, it's not Renfro alone has the good ideas. Moving on, Michael writes, Like what the United Auto Workers did to help keep that industry solvent, agreeing to the Table 2 wage structure and a non-career workforce was our great sacrifice to help the Postal Service survive. We also worked through the pandemic without the hazard pay that some other workers received, not missing a day of service to the American people. Now that the Postal Service is back on solid footing, it's time to achieve big wage increases. Oh no, it's time to reward our craft. We saw how the UAW and the Teamsters and other unions were able to achieve big wage increases and other contractual gains in 2023, and we need to be able to do the same for our hardworking letter carriers. We cannot continue to act like a company union that's only willing to fight like hell when the employer needs our assistance. While ensuring the... All right, I got to acknowledge that's a pretty good shot across the bow at Brian Renfro, where when it was time for the, you know, the contract negotiations, we had the hell no rally, but that was, you know, his big rally was the fight like hell, and that was fight like hell, or what? Which one was, I don't remember. But anyway, the moral of the story is, yeah, we held this rally to protect the Postal Service, which also protects us. But where was that rally of public support when we needed it for our fellow carriers, you know, for our contract? Okay, while ensuring the Postal Service remains financially stable and independent is important, we must not sacrifice our future. Fighting for our wages and benefits must come first. We've been playing defense for 15 years. It's time to go on offense. There is no value in delaying the resolution of our contract, and I promise to move the process along, enacting our plans and strategies along the way. If the Postal Service does not want to resolve the contract directly with us, we will go to arbitration as soon as possible. Currently, we are suffering from the ravages of inflation and the undervalued contracts we've agreed to recently. Help, in the form of a workable contract, can't come soon enough. And this is where there's obviously a lot of overlap between Kerev's platform and James Henry's platform. You know, they both kind of see these same problems with Brian Renfro, and the opposite, you know, the resolutions seem pretty clear. Moving on. The process that President Renfro utilized for bargaining from 23 to 25 did not work and cannot be repeated. We also need to save the Postal Service from itself, and the sooner we get started, the better. It is unlikely they will correct their flawed structure by themselves. They will need the help of an arbitrator, Congress, the Board of Governors, and the American people they are supposed to serve. Lastly, General Resolution 12 from the 2024 Convention is now the law of the land. As approved by the delegates, it resolves to 1. Hold rallies involving every branch leading up to the formal start of negotiations, highlighting our demands, and throughout a contract campaign when necessary, activating the membership at certain key points in negotiations. Yeah, great point, Mike Kerev. I kind of forgot about that there's already this demand from the delegates at the convention that we hold these rallies that already passed. And 2, post monthly bargaining updates of issues, wages, hours, and working conditions. And General Resolution 22 also calls updates on the first and third of every month and in the postal record. Thank you, Branch 1779 Lakeland, Florida, and Branch 2525 Escondido, California. Transparency within our union and activism in the streets will help us to get a better contract. Yeah, that's obviously true. Or at least that's the belief that we're pushing back against from, you know, what we got out of Brian Renfro. Next, the future of the Postal Service. Former Postmaster General DeJoy's 10-year Delivering for America plan is now in its fifth year. To date, it has deliberately slowed down mail delivery and is undermining the fundamental principle of universal access to reliable postal services for all Americans. On-time delivery rates have plummeted everywhere the plan has been implemented. This plan threatens to unravel the fabric of our communities, particularly those in rural and underserved areas, where timely mail is a lifeline for essential goods, services, and communication. The creation of SNDCs, that's sorting and delivery centers, has gone mostly unchallenged by our union. There are many considerations when the Postal Service expands facilities and adds letter carrier routes to a facility. Some of those issues are start times or work commutes, and sometimes it's the facility itself. I want to speak on that for just a sec, because there's talk about moving to sorting and delivery centers in Las Vegas, and apparently we already have two of them, which the union has not been vocal about one way or the other. And you heard Michael on recently saying that his station got turned into an SNDC, and he didn't even know because the union never spoke up. So this idea that we might go down to just a few stations, at first it seemed appealing until somebody pointed out, well, Alan, your station might be in, you know, this part of town where they're talking about building one. And that would turn my commute from like a 6-minute commute to a 30-minute commute. And that sucks. That's bad. And so yeah, Mike's right. He mentions work commutes in here. Moving on, he says, we've seen unsafe working conditions, and we have also seen the Postal Service make unilateral decisions without communication or input from the union. Our sibling postal unions have also been affected by the consolidation of the network that has been taking place, and we should be in that fight too. We should unite with Congress and the American people to demand that no changes be implemented to the postal network where they will slow down the mail. We fundamentally oppose any deterioration in the service standards, and the Delivering for America plan is doing just that. Here, I salute our members in Branch 3, led by President David Grosskopf. Hell yeah, David Grosskopf. They worked with Congress, the public, and the other unions to get the closing of the Buffalo, New York plant taken off the consideration list. Let us follow their lead. Yeah, we need some of that locally. And nationally, obviously. The center of the Postal Service's network, the greatest in the history of the world, has to be consistent and reliable service from a professional, uniformed letter carrier. The American people deserve no less. And it's something we should fight for in the cities that currently receive rural delivery instead. Dude, it's so crazy to me. Like here in Las Vegas, we have plenty of rural carriers, and they deliver to these big master plan communities that are, you know, right in town, and they have cluster boxes and apartments, and there is no definition of rural that meets that, you know, that this is the city and that should be city delivery. Moving on. We also want to grow our network to meet modern delivery demands, particularly small parcels. We should have our own plan for a successful postal service to fulfill our universal service mandate and be prepared to present it to anyone who wants to privatize or sell off any aspect of this network. Without any tax revenue whatsoever, all Americans have the privilege of a letter carrier delivering mail and goods to them and picking up whatever they want to place in the mail stream. We are valuable parts of every community in America, and we should fight to preserve this national treasure. One of the things that I've heard Cariff talk about on, like just recently was on Next Generation Carriers, is that we should consider getting a monopoly on Spurs in addition to first class mail, because as first class mail diminishes, that was what was financially supporting the Postal Service. And with that going away, we don't have that financial footing that was granted to us by the monopoly status. And so something has to replace it. It's an interesting argument. I'll probably talk to him about that tomorrow. Moving on, he writes, we want the Postal Service to run well, and we want to provide excellent and efficient universal service to the American people. The Board of Governors has appointed David Steiner as new Postmaster General. I will work with any Postmaster General who shares our vision, but I will use the full power of our union to oppose any Postmaster General who seeks to erode our service and diminish the postal network. Next topic is grievance process. After we negotiate the national contract, the next step is to enforce its terms. It's imperative that we have a grievance process that works. The delays at step B of the dispute resolution process are unacceptable. No member wants to hear, file a grievance, and then wait. Our members deserve results. Additionally, due to a higher rate of impasse at Step B, management refusing to acquiesce to obvious violations and apply appropriate remedies, the regional offices are inundated with too many grievances. It's almost impossible to put all of these issues in front of regional arbitrators and get grievance resolutions for our members in a timely manner. Of course, the Postal Service is perfectly fine with delaying our grievances. Their management team did whatever they wanted to do, and we are the ones who need our issues addressed. In 2024, I proposed that the Executive Council of the NALC form a committee to discuss how we can address these unacceptable delays. Even this minor step was rejected by President Renfro and the council. And instead, he insists that we pretend that a problem does not exist. One thing we can do is file a national grievance to enforce the terms of the dispute resolution process memorandum in the JCAM. This memo states that the parties will activate backup teams where they are available and needed. 35 branch presidents in my region sent a letter to President Renfro and Executive Vice President Barner stating this on February 15th of this year. And at the 2024 convention in Boston, we passed a resolution presented by Branch 11 Chicago that requires the president to file a national grievance when this issue presents itself. The Postal Service... So, what was the result of that? Has there been a national level grievance? Because, like, it seems like we need one. I'll have to ask him about that. The Postal Service clearly doesn't want to utilize the extra resources required to hear grievances in a timely manner. And they clearly do not want to direct their managers, supervisors, and postmasters to follow our contract. So what is our response to this? I agree with Vice President James Henry that the DRT serves as the backstop of the grievance arbitration process. We are certainly willing to work with the Postal Service to update the DRP, dispute resolution process, and make it more efficient, and this must be addressed in the next round of bargaining. But in the meantime, they must adhere to its terms. It is not optional. Next topic is joint processes. I put the word joint in quotations. Oh yeah, he put the word joint in quotations. Because these are not really joint processes that we are entering into. The employer controls the means to make decisions. They hire people. They assign duties. If the only way we can reverse a decision they have made is to beg them through some alternative dispute resolution process to correct their improper decision, then we have already lost. Dude, I dealt with that when I had my issue at the Carrier Academy. And management, in this alternative dispute resolution, they just have to cooperate. And if they're not interested in cooperating, then you're pretty much out of luck. All right, moving on, he says. I promise you that if I am your president, any process we agree to will be spelled out in the collective bargaining agreement and not in some side memo with the phony ADR. We have seen the results of these joint processes, and they are not good. We saw this with the TREAP, the joint route process memo that finally expired on May 31st, 2024. In that process, our NALC reps were isolated from the programs that are used to make the evaluations and adjustments. We also allowed the Postal Service to put in parameters that management is using to create street standards that do not exist. Now, dude, if you listen to 8 Arbitration, Corey talks about that a lot. Moving on. Even though there are no street standards whatsoever and there's no requirement to be moving at all times, managers are also using similar software to harass carriers about daily street activity or stationary times without actually going out to the street to supervise us. The memo used the USPS Core Route Adjustment Program, which unnecessarily makes drastic changes to current routes that were bid on by senior carriers. Suffice it to say, any route adjustment process we agree to must make sense and also be included as part of the contract so we can grieve any improper actions that come from it. This seems perfectly reasonable. This is a good solution. And again, you know, James Henry said the same thing, that having a process that we cannot grieve by its very nature does not work. Moving on, we have an agreement, M1879, on training for our craft that local management routinely fails to follow. They do not schedule new carriers for training in a timely manner, or do not use certified on-the-job instructors, or do not want to schedule Carrier Academy facilitators, etc. And what is our recourse? We initiate a dispute, and someone in USPS middle management promises us they will do better while making no actual changes. Look at that. Mike speaks directly to the ADR process. At the Carrier Academy, dude, it's the pits. He goes on. If we do not like that, we can still appeal it to upper management to give us the same fake response. Unacceptable. Oh my God, it's like he was there. Of course, because, yeah, it's the same issue going on. M1968 is one of the most poorly written memos I have ever seen. It is supposed to allow letter carriers to work details in areas that need help, but it has no teeth and relies on management to pick whoever they want to send into the new area. It does not work and it cannot be fixed. We should withdraw from this agreement immediately and start anew. Yeah, I'm not familiar with, I'm familiar with carriers going on details. We have carriers at my own station who go, but yeah, I don't know the details of this agreement. Moving on, he writes, another joint process we have agreed to, although it's not even codified in an additional official memorandum, is the ADR to resolve issues related to the filing of letter carrier vacancies. I will end this thing on day one because it is inferior to the Article 15 dispute resolution process that we already have. We have highly trained NALC Step B reps who know how to evaluate an issue, figure out what happened, compare that to what should have happened, and then work with management to apply the appropriate remedy. That last part is particularly onerous for our members in this ADR process. Management is routinely posting routes late and delaying the conversion of CCAs and PTFs to full-time regulars. This practice must cease immediately, and the affected letter carrier should receive substantial compensation for the time they were improperly relegated to non-career status. There is no way our employer can go back and give them those Sundays with their family, the time they could have had off work if they did not want to be on the ODL, the better health insurance they should have had access to, and the Fegley life insurance they hopefully did not need. Dude, this is so, he's so right about that, because you can't really make somebody whole for the time that you stole from them. Next topic, contract enforcement. In my region, we are very aggressive in dealing with contract enforcement. We simply cannot allow management to manage or mismanage as they see fit anymore. The terms of the contract are useless if they are not adhered to. The difficulty with this issue is that we have no control over the managerial decisions that local managers make. We cannot fire them, demote them, or rewind the clock to fix what they did wrong. Our only recourse is to make them pay enough that they must change their ways. Because of this strategy, and by taking a collaborative approach to our grievances, we have won millions of dollars for our letter carriers and local branches. We estimate that the Chicago Post Office pays out over $10 million in grievance settlements each year. Money in and of itself does not fix the problem, but it does make it palatable to our members and restores some justice to counteract management's intransigence. At least a dozen offices in my region have received payments to the local branch to offset damage that is done to our credibility with the membership when the contract is not adhered to by management. If you're interested in reading more about the Region 3 strategy, read the Noncompliance Roadmap. So that is a clickable link, which this is already long enough. I'm not going to get sidetracked here. But he has a Noncompliance Roadmap, so that's pretty good. I mean, this platform seems quite thorough. Moving on. I've been asked by some members, hey Mike, when are we going to stop with the ever-escalating remedies? We certainly do not want to bankrupt our only employer, the United States Postal Service. The answer is simple. We are going to keep our collective boots on their neck until management starts coming into the office and going home with one thing on their mind, complying with the terms of the contract that USPS has with our members. The sooner we get there, the better. A boss who cannot manage within the contractual framework that we have agreed to is a detriment to the organization. We need to do everything in our power to help the postal hierarchy come to that same conclusion. In my tenure as MBA, we've had some substantial arbitration wins. Even before the new contract language addressing the issue, in one of our offices, we forced the service to post a notice about work hour limits and send the carriers home once they reach them. In another, we forced them to provide COVID-related medical info to grievance handlers, which they were refusing to do around the country, with no response at all from the national union. We forced them to pay continuation of pay, even if the carrier's OWCP claim was denied, because the interruption in the letter carrier's pay is a violation of the law. We have virtually closed the door on emergency placement suspensions that are only based on allegations, a huge problem in the whole country. We won an arbitration where the service denied light duty work to a CCA, successfully arguing that the Pregnancy Discrimination Act applied. Dude, this stuff's cool. This is like using the law, not just the contract. All right, moving on. We also won an arbitration award that requires an automatic remedy of $2,500 to the local union every single time they violate a previous cease and desist order or do not adhere to a grievance settlement. We should be able to go about our daily rounds based on our craft duties, as laid out in the M41 handbook. We don't need supervisors who are certainly no experts in how to do our job, telling us what to do and harassing us constantly. Getting rid of the Board of Supervisors altogether is the solution to many of our problems. It is unconscionable that our employer hires so many people to watch what we're doing all day and has the nerve to cry broke when we go to negotiate a new contract. These supervisors who want us to explain each idle minute of our day to them are literally stationary the entire day. We have been successful in getting many of them barred from supervising letter carriers based on the work environment that they have created. We also created an abusive supervisor worksheet that we hand out to carriers to help them report each incident of harassment, bullying, intimidation, and threatening behavior. There is zero tolerance for this type of management, and we should file grievances every time it happens. There is no such thing as an incident that rises to the level of the joint statement on violence and behavior violation. Every incident that violates the zero tolerance policy is a violation, and every violation has an appropriate remedy. I would say that's why it's called a zero tolerance policy. He goes on. Management does not get the chance to correct their behavior. Oh, management does get the chance to correct their behavior, but they do not get the chance to continue their behavior. Next topic is training. Now we get to the stuff that I'm especially interested in. I am very curious to see whether Mike mentions training rank and file carriers and not just like stewards and presidents and such. By the way, I have not read this before. I read like the first three pages and then I realized I better just read this live. So reading this all live and I don't edit. So you're getting my fresh reactions. All right, moving on. Training. Our NALC branches are tasked with enforcing the contract at the informal and formal A levels. Each branch president is the chief steward within that branch's jurisdiction. The national union assists the branches by overseeing a training program mainly through the regional offices. In Region 3, we certainly do not have a monopoly on the great training that is going on throughout our union. Yet we've been able to lead the way on some things. We do a regional leadership academy, the only one in the country. We do our own Formal A training to ensure that anyone who is doing Formal A as the branch president or their designee has been properly trained. Sometimes the cost of sending that person to advanced Formal A and beyond training is not feasible for the branch, and sometimes they want to supplement that excellent training from NALC headquarters. We regularly put on an 8-hour new steward class in various geographic locations throughout the region, and recently we've added ongoing steward classes too. This is in addition to the classes and workshops we put on during regional training and the Illinois State Convention and annual steward training. All right, so this is good. Obviously, you know, bringing training to the people who need it is helpful. He goes on. I would like to use our training model as the basis for a national training program run through the regional offices. Any training we do should be interactive. That's how people learn. I also believe in in-person training, although there is room for a virtual element too. In-person training allows the class participants to network and helps establish an ongoing mentor-mentee relationship between the instructors and class participants. No matter the training program that we establish, the overriding principle must be that excellent training will be available to all at the cheapest possible price to our branch partners. The union sets the standard for training, regardless of what branch you are in or what area of the country you live in. That will be a priority of my administration. Okay, so I like that he's at least open to the idea of virtual training, online classes, something like that, because that obviously opens it to a lot more people. So far, I'm not seeing anything about regular carriers. We'll move on. One concept we will explore further is to establish a grievance app accessible by all members and local branches. This would allow members to initiate grievances, get information, and communicate directly with their branch union handlers. For the branches, they would be able to track grievances and store them more effectively and have access to grievance starters and other helpful tools. The point is that we will coordinate grievance activities so that each member gets great representation. The national union will assist the local branch to help make that happen. So this seems like an obvious good idea to me. We have these resources at the national level. We file the same grievances over and over again. There really should be computer programs, maybe even AI solutions that you kind of just plug in the new numbers and it gives you the grievance. You know, like Article 8 should be able to be handled by a computer program. His next topic, union structure and collaboration. Okay, so that means that training for rank and file carriers, not on the list. So that's definitely something I'm going to talk to him about. Union structure and collaboration. My approach to leadership is to try to put the best people in the position to optimize their strengths, regardless of anyone's political loyalties. We are a fraternal organization. We all want what is best for our fellow letter carriers and our union. This is a great strength that we fail to unleash when we have two NALCs, one for the powerful and well-connected, and another for the rank and file. Dude. Yeah, he's right about that. In Region 3, we meet with all our branch presidents and other leaders in the region weekly. I will ask each region to do something similar. Coordinated action between the branches and the national union is essential, and the regional offices are the meeting point. We must close the gap between leadership and membership in our union. The Executive Council is supposed to run our union in between conventions. However, in its current structure, we are neither executive nor council. With all the issues facing us as letter carriers, the council does not have a single subcommittee formed to discuss and figure out how to tackle issues. Most decisions, like hiring and other financial considerations, and collective bargaining and other contractual issues, are made by a small group of people who work directly for the president. I will utilize the strengths of all our elected officers and ask them to assist with the work of the union. We can start with the contract administration unit. Currently, there is not a single person on that committee who is not housed in Washington, D.C. That makes no sense, and it hurts our ability to be aware of and coordinate our response to the issues that affect letter carriers on the workroom floor. Dude, this is so true. Like, we feel that there's a disconnect between the carrier on the workroom floor and union leadership because there is a disconnect between those two, and that's what Mike is talking about here. He goes on. Speaking of the workroom floor, too many of our leaders have not sniffed one in far too long. I make sure to carry my route as much as I can, usually about a week each year. I also utilize Article 23 to visit with the carriers at their workplace regularly. The membership elects who they want, your branch president, the MBA, etc. But for the appointed positions of the NALC, one of the factors is going to be how close they are to the workroom floor. As a general rule, our union leaders should be letter carriers, not office workers. Hell yeah. He goes on. I promise you this. As your president, I will still carry my route periodically so that I keep the strong connection I have to the struggles of every letter carrier. You know, this is something that I was talking to somebody about it, that we don't have, like, Mike is the closest thing we have to a letter carrier in this position of leadership, that he actually does carry mail from time to time. I don't know how long it's been since James Henry has carried mail. I don't know how long it's been since Brian Renfro has carried mail or Paul Barner or any of the other people. But, you know, even though, so I love that Mike still makes an effort to actually carry mail and be on the workroom floor. And with James Henry, you know, at least, even if he doesn't carry the mail himself, at least he's willing to, like, talk and listen to people. Whereas Renfro has that, I know better and I'm going to go it alone. And combining that with that disconnect from the workroom floor is a big part of our problem. All right, he goes on. I'm going to work together with the national business agents that you elect to evaluate each of our appointed union reps, RAAs, RGAs. There's a bunch of abbreviations here. We have some of the most talented, dedicated, and passionate letter carriers working for us. I just want to make sure that each position is being utilized based on their skill set and what is in the best interest of the union. Some of the people working currently in the regional offices can also help at NALC headquarters. We can figure out the logistics in order to be efficient and utilize our talent in the most effective way possible. The NALC is one union, and the regional offices are part of that union, not separate entities. As we go through the process of figuring out who and the where, We want to make sure that our union leadership reflects the makeup of the membership in all ways. That will be a priority of mine as well. Make no mistake, I will not sweep out everyone simply because they are part of the old guard. That's funny because that's exactly what I was thinking about as I was reading this. Is like, so is this his license that he's going to like go after political opponents? No, he addresses it. So that's cool. He continues. When I first ran for the Region 3 NBA, Tony Hudson, then an RAA, was my opponent. Tony fought a great fight, but once the election was over, we met and planned how we were going to work together. He is a talented brother, and we still work together and are good friends to this day. Politically motivated decision-making has no place in our union. Every decision should be based on what is in our collective best interest as a union. I want people who do good work, and I want the best we have to offer. It is okay to disagree. I encourage it. But when I'm spending dues dollars on your behalf, you deserve and should expect the best. Too often, the unsung heroes, the grievance handlers, the arbitration advocates, and the DRT team members are passed over because they are not friends with the right people, regardless of their performance. Dude, it's so true. This will never happen in a CARF administration, and no one will be blackballed for speaking out. Dude, I love that he addresses this directly. You know, this is obviously that's what's needed. You know, Mike Brazenly and I have similar platform at the local level that we have a non-retaliation policy. Moving on. The size of our payroll at NALC headquarters is larger than it has ever been, but our members are not seeing better results. Our finances are in good shape due to some great investments and other financial decisions. Still, we need to be fiscally responsible and make good decisions to keep our union strong into the future. I will not micromanage our people, nor do I plan to nitpick and be cheap with our reimbursements. If you know, you know. I don't know. But every officer of the union will be tasked with keeping costs down in their area of influence. For those who do work for our union as nationally assigned assistants, I will make sure that you do not have to wait to have your out-of-pocket expenses reimbursed. Yeah, I can see how that would be a problem. Like, you have to fly somewhere. You know, it's not like everybody has this big nest egg that they can just tap into. He goes on. Lastly, we cannot hide our business from the members. We must operate in the light and not in the shadows. One of my first executive orders will be to require the posting of the minutes of the executive council on the members-only portal immediately after they have been approved by the council. James Henry has an almost identical thing on his platform. And you know, I love this push for openness. I think this is a big step in the right direction. Moving on. We will also live stream our national rap sessions and biennial conventions. Never again can an officer of this union face serious charges and not be held accountable while the membership is left in the dark. We, the officers of this union, work for you, the membership, never the other way around. Yeah, obviously, I agree with that. Moving on, member services. In the 1890s, shortly after the NALC got its start, the NALC Mutual Benefit Association was founded. The MBA's purpose was to provide various insurances to members of our craft. In 1950, NALC created its own health benefit plan to give our members health care, which was not a benefit at that time. It's time to expand our member services beyond insurance. Today's challenges are different. The last 40 years have been a time of declining interest rates and easy credit. That period is coming to an end for the foreseeable future. This year we saw mortgage rates hit 7%, and they may soon exceed 8% while the cost of home ownership continues to rise. I believe it's time to explore the idea of an NALC credit union to serve our members nationwide and provide them with low-cost, affordable loans at competitive interest rates. If we can't achieve that, we can at least negotiate agreements with lenders to provide our members with a streamlined process and better rates given our layoff protection clause and workforce stability. I don't know. That one might be a bit of a reach. I mean, I do like the NALC health benefit plan. And if it's run, you know, with less profit in mind, maybe that would be beneficial to us. It does seem like there's a lot of resources out there. I don't know. I don't know about that one. Next, organizing. In December of 2018, then-President Rolando made the following statement in his installation speech. So, one of the top priorities of the new NALC Executive Council will be to respond in a way that upholds employment standards in the delivery industry and protects the job of American City letter carriers. In the early part of 2022, I was assigned, that was a quote from Renfro, now that's an end quote. I guess I probably should have said quote on that one. Anyway, in the early part of 2022, I was assigned to Southern Alabama to work with a group of our members and members of other unions to help with the unionization campaign at the Amazon facility in Bessemer, Alabama. We learned some valuable lessons in union organizing during that campaign. Organizing is something we excel at when we sign letter carriers up to the NELC. In Region 3, we sign up over 99% of new employees and keep at least a 97% rate overall. And the rest of the country is doing a similar job as well. Even though external organizing is not something letter carriers have ever done, I have the feeling it is something we could get fairly good at. I want to coordinate a plan with the Executive Council to help organize Amazon delivery drivers. There are now more Amazon delivery drivers than city letter carriers in our country. Amazon is eating away at our delivery network by paying less and offering little in retirement and other benefits. It's definitely not a career job. If we could help to organize Amazon delivery drivers and in the process make that a good union job, it would help us out a lot, both in the short term, think contract negotiations where there's comparison to the private sector, and in the long term by slowing Amazon's growth. If they had to pay good wages and treat their delivery drivers decently, they may not be so anxious to expand and take away work that should be done by city letter carriers. You know, I like this. This is, in business speak, this would be like horizontal integration, where you start taking over some of your competitors, bring them into the fold, and now, you know, you're all kind of under that same umbrella. And anything that gets more people unionized, I'm in favor of that. Next topic, legislation. We must also reform the way we do business on Capitol Hill. Legislation remains one of the greatest threats to our craft, but it can also aid us. We have failed miserably in this regard. It took over 15 years to fix the last flawed postal reform bill. We finally got the Social Security Fairness Act passed after 40 years. We're getting nowhere with the Retirement Fairness Act. We let Congress raise our FERS contribution from 0.8% to 4.4%, and our injured members are the only federal employees who inexplicably cannot receive wage loss compensation for the first 3 days following an injury. We want to help the Postal Service be financially strong, and we have a long history of helping with this, but our legislative program must be for us. We need a stronger legislative arm to address the current threats to our retirement. Congress has proposed eliminating the FERS supplement for all federal workers except those with a mandatory retirement age, which is primarily law enforcement and firefighters. We need a carve-out for letter carriers. This is a physically demanding job, and there needs to be an exception for us. We spend so much time on the street and on our feet these days. Our government should not be allowed to break its word to us. Many of our members may have 20 to 25 years, and now as they prepare for retirement, they're going to pull the rug out from under us. This is unacceptable. Let's fight to achieve paid parental leave for all letter carriers who are moms and dads and those who want to be. Caring for a new baby is hard work, and so is our job. It's uncivilized to require you to do both. We should not be the only part of the federal government that does not have this paid leave. I mean, yeah, this is an important issue, especially if you're Mike Cariff and you got like 13 kids. That's a lot of leave. I don't know if he would never come back to work. In 2006, we asked our state associations to become NELC's political arm. I will work with regional offices to collaborate with our state associations so they can do just that. Our network of legislative liaisons to each congressional office in the country is a very good starting point. We have a good lobbying program in D.C., but our strength is that we have members in every nook and cranny of this country. Where we have friends in Congress, those friends need to be able to help pass legislation for us. I will task each state association to produce a game plan on how we can solidify ties with our friends in Congress, regardless of their political persuasion. Where we cannot do that, we will make plans to elect real friends in those districts. We will focus our LCPF monies on those specific areas and work to mobilize our members who live and vote there. We have about 500 members in every congressional district in America. Never again will we spend LCPF dollars or endorse local candidates without first discussing it with the leaders of our state associations. They know the local issues and how to identify the candidates who will win. This seems reasonable. Like, I heard him mention this on Next Generation Carriers the other day, that with 500 carriers in every congressional district, it feels like we should be able to apply more pressure than we're doing. But again, we have this big force of carriers that it's just untapped. Next, stamp out hunger. Letter carriers highlight our essential role in the nation's communities every year by conducting the largest one-day food drive on the second Saturday in May. While funding sources and other issues continue to be a concern for the local food pantries we serve, hungry Americans should always be able to count on their letter carriers. Our national leadership should follow the lead of Florida, where Al Friedman is the president. They're able to secure bags for everyone at a low price for our sponsors or the branches, and they lead the way every year. I will say, in my own experience, the bags really help. Unfortunately, NALC headquarters sends out fewer and smaller food drive cards every year, despite those cards being delivered for free with the G10 postage paid emblem. USPS doesn't prioritize the food drive as they once did, and the NALC should be pushing the opposite direction, not following their lead. Yeah, the food drive, to me, is one of the most satisfying days of the year. Ooh, we're getting close to the end. Next, safety on the street. There used to be a time in America where everyone on the street knew to leave the letter carrier alone. Those days are gone, and now we are being assaulted and robbed at alarming rates. Recently, our sister Octavia Redmond was shot dead while delivering mail in full uniform. We held a rally at the Branch 11 Union Hall immediately afterward, and you can see my speech that day here. It's a clickable link on a site. There are some good provisions in the Protect Our Letter Carriers Act. There is also good language in the Postal Police Reform Act, and we should be advocating for the passage of both. The latter would require the Postal Service to have a dedicated police force out on the street with us. They would be able to coordinate activity with municipal police and be a resource to us while we deliver the mail. Postal police presence would improve our safety on the street. So I think that's got to be an issue where every candidate, including Renfro, is on the same page with supporting those issues. Finally, we are here. Conclusion. Brothers and sisters, this concludes my proposals to make our union stronger. Thank you for taking the time to read it. And thank you to Alan for reading it to everybody. He doesn't say that, but I'm sure it's implied. Anyway, he goes on. I do not have all the answers, but luckily my fellow letter carriers have never been shy about sharing their thoughts and opinions. I promise we will work together to refine and improve upon this platform in the next 2 years. You can send a message through the careforprez.org website or find me on all the various social media platforms under the same name. If you want to volunteer to help, we would love to have you. Just reach out through the website. I've also begun traveling the country with the Kick the Tires tour, so let me know when you want me to come to an event in your area. Although activism within the NALC is generally on the rise, participation by our members in the last election was abysmal. Let us start the process now of debate and discussion in every branch and post office in the country. What direction do we want to take in 2026? The Care for Prez campaign will also be working with precinct captains in as many post offices as possible to rally our members to participate in the 2026 NALC election. When the membership participates in their union, it makes for a stronger union. I've never been more optimistic about our future because I know in my heart what we can do and will do together. I've had countless interactions with so many of our union activists over the years. We have a great union with so many great people. What we really need is guidance and coordination. And I want to help bring that type of leadership to our union. If you will have me, I am ready, willing, and able to serve you as president for the 2026 to 2030 term. We must all work together to bring positive change to our beloved union. And that's it. That is the end of the Cariff for President platform. So you've heard it. You probably have your own thoughts on it. I certainly have some of mine. The biggest disappointment in it is no real mention of training for regular rank and file carriers. The whole training segment was very small. And there are issues that I want to bring to Mike's attention that I think need to be addressed. There are certainly things that I like. I like his direct pushback against the cronyism and the good old boy network within our union, the gatekeeping and blackballing. For obvious reasons, that's an issue that's close to my heart. So we're going to have plenty to talk about tomorrow. So thank you guys for listening and check out the next episode when I have on Mike Karif. Take care, guys. Catch you next time.